Hello and welcome once again, podcasters, to this series of podcasts brought to you by Kilkenny Library Services in partnership with Kilkenny County Council and the Decade of Centenaries Fund. My name is Owen Swinton Welsh, and in these podcasts we focus on revolutionary era Kilkenny. Today I thought we'd look at the female-only organisation Cumann na mBan in County Kilkenny during this period. The origins of the National Cumann na mBan organisation, which literally translates as the Women's Council, dates back to April 1914 when it was formed at Wynn's Hotel in Dublin. Wynn's is still there, of course, on Abbey Street, people might know us, but it is the rebuilt Wynn's that's there now, as the original was destroyed during the 1916 Rising. Even at the first meeting in the formation of Cumann na mBan, the attendees, which included Countess Markovich and Jenny Wise Power, disagreed over what role the organisation should play in regard to the male Irish volunteers organisation. Markovich was adamant they should not be a female auxiliary to the Irish volunteers. In her mind, that would make them subservient to the men and they would end up being instructed by the men. It was decided that they would instead become a sister organisation to the Irish Volunteers, which made them an independent organisation and not just an auxiliary or add-on to the Irish Volunteers. Some women would have agreed with the course of action, some wouldn't. Now, I just mentioned this just to show that there was often debates within the female nationalist suffrage and republican movements in how much power they should yield to men. But indeed, it should be also be noticed that when it came to the thick of the action in rural Kilkenny in 1921, I'm sure these kinds of issues were the last thing on the minds of the Kilkenny Cumann na mBan members. They were just getting on with the job in hand. This leads us on then to what role Cumann na mBan played during this period. If there has been one great benefit of this decade of centenaries we're all living through at the moment, it's that it has expanded our knowledge of all the different elements of the revolutionary era. Indeed, not just the role of women. Arguably, prior to the centenary events, most historical narratives prioritised the ambushes and the attacks between the IRA and the Crown Forces. In other words, the military campaign was the only show in town. This, of course, left large gaps in other aspects of the revolutionary period, such as the political movement, the labour movement, the role of the media and propaganda, the suffrage movement, and, of course, the role of women in revolutionary Ireland. Indeed, the social revolution, with all the changes that occurred with that, was also overlooked to an extent. For example, the near tripling of the electorate in the 1918 general election, followed by the local elections of 1920, allowed many men and women to vote for the very first time. Now, this is not to downplay the importance of the military aspects. Ambushes and fatalities to both the Crown Forces and the IRA, and later the Free States Army, is what really made the news headlines both nationally and internationally. But it's important to remember that not everyone could or wanted to be holding a gun in an ambush, but nonetheless they wanted to contribute to the cause in whatever way they could. None more so than the women of Cumann na mBan. Their roles were varied and wide-ranging. Providing safe houses was a key component. That meant being available day and night. Food was then needed and often fresh clothes was required for the men. This was a time expense as well as a monetary expense to the women and their households. Their homes were then targeted for raids by the Crown Forces and during the Civil War by the Free States Army. Thus, they would be subjected to the full brunt of the repercussions for their activities. The raids were often the most traumatic and anxiety-inducing aspect of their role. With the men frequently on the run, they were often left alone when a large group of men would enter their household and search and raid. Women, unlike the men, did not really have the option to go on the run. The raids and searches on the homes of Cumann na mBan women during the Civil War were often more frequent and thorough than during the War of Independence. Ellen Leahy of the 7th Battalion had endured many raids by Crown Forces during the Independence era, as her brother James was 7th Battalion OC and a column leader at one stage. She considered the Free State raids worst of all. Quote, "We always referred to the Free State Army as the Tans, as they gave us far more trouble here. Some of them being callers to this house while they were in the movement in 1920 and 1921 period. Then the split came and some turned their coats and persecuted those who had befriended them previously." End quote. Dispatch carrying was another major important element of their work. At the peak of the War of Independence in early 1921, dispatches were often sent on numerous occasions in a single day. Members of Cumannamon and the IRA would travel for miles across parishes to deliver dispatches. They established chains of communication where the dispatch would be passed from one woman to the next in the neighbouring district and so on. Women were considered a safer option to transmit messages as they were less likely to be stopped and searched. Cumannamon women also had a reputation of being more reliable and time efficient in their deliveries. Indeed, Garrett Brennan, who was officer commanding of Castlecomer's 3rd Battalion area, made that very point in relation to the Coolbawn ambush in June 1921, where time, of course, was of the essence. Understandably, very important dispatches were sent the day before the ambush to the various company captains around the area in order to have men and arms ready for the next day. He noted, quote, "I wrote dispatches to 10 company captains, directing them to send 4 men each to Coolbawn, arriving at 4 a.m. the next day. The dispatches were sent off from 2 p.m. according as cyclists could be found. The dispatches to H and L companies, that's the Upper Hills and the Swan companies respectively, were sent by members of Cumannamon and were about the only ones delivered on time." End quote. Two members of Cumannamon from Paulstown, Helen Fottrell, née Murphy of Mount Rothe House, and Margaret Prendergast, née Welsh, brought first aid, explosives and ammo to the Coolbawn site prior to the ambush. This was the 4th Battalion's way of helping out their neighbours in the 3rd Battalion. The role of the Cumannamon women changed and adapted throughout the period, depending on what was happening. In the early days, fundraising for the Republican movement was a big thing, especially after 1916 with the Prisoners and Families Dependence Funds coming into existence then. Many Cumannamon women later had roles in the Irish White Cross, which distributed funds to affected families. Most of this organization's money was raised in America. Cumannamon also protested widely, none more important than the hundreds of Kilkenny women who marched against conscription in May and June 1918. They also signed the Anti-Conscription Pledge on Lawnamon in June 1918, basically similar to a petition. It was a list of signatures objecting to the military draft. The list of names is housed in Rothe House, Kilkenny, and is now up online on the Kilkenny Archaeological Society website, thanks to Orla Murphy al. During this period, women were much less likely to be arrested than the men, so it made their very public and visible protests all the more important. As the violence increased, their duties became more frontline, so to speak. They had to be in the vicinity of planned ambushes and RAC barracks attacks in case first aid was needed. Their presence near Huggenstown barracks attack, the Friary Street ambush and the Civil War Battle of Kilkenny spring to mind immediately. Many Cumannamon women took it upon themselves to learn first aid and to deliver courses of that nature. Some women of Cumannamon also became adept in cleaning weapons and guns. Another very important task for them throughout the War of Independence and Civil War was the delivery and the storing of ammunition and guns. For the same reason as mentioned with dispatches previously, they were much less likely to be stopped and searched when getting from point A to point B. But it was also very dangerous work, firstly in regards to being caught with the material of this nature, but also when dealing with weapons and explosives, as accidents could happen. So that's the high-level view of Cumannamon and what it did and what were its objectives. To tell the story of the Kilkenny women of Cumannamon, I'm going to try to pick out some individual members and then detail parts of their accounts and their experiences. Firstly, just to give an overview of what exists in the records, I'll be relying heavily on the Military Service Pensions collection in the Military Archives, you might have heard of it. From the viewpoint of historians, this is an amazing resource where, after 1934, women could apply for the modest military pension. They had to give very detailed accounts about what they did. They often had to do interviews in front of a panel about their various activities. They had to back it all up with references as well. Although it was never intended for the purpose historians now use it for, without this set of records, our understanding of Cumannamon and Kilkenny, and indeed Ireland as a whole, would have been severely diminished. Now, on the other hand, it's important to mention that if you are one of these women who applied for the pension, there's a good chance you hated the process and cursed the people making the decisions. It was a pain in regards to all the paperwork that was required. The process literally dragged on for years and years before a decision was taken. But ultimately, many women felt insulted when they were rejected from getting a pension. Now, if any members of your family were not approved for a pension, please don't feel that it was a reflection of their revolutionary contribution. It was very difficult to get a military service pension for men, but especially so for women. Now, we don't have the final exact number of applications and rejections just yet, as they are not all released. But in terms of both men and women over the decades, we think approximately 80,000 people in total applied for a military service pension, and perhaps only about 16 to 17,000 of those were approved. So you're talking about just a 1 in 5 or a 1 in 6 chance of getting your pension approved. There was certainly no such thing as a soft pension approved by any means, which the near bankrupt Irish Free State were going to avoid at all costs. But then again, I suppose on the other side of the coin, at least the government had some kind of pension for the revolutionary generation. They could have done nothing. It's also good to note that in rural areas around Kilkenny and Ireland generally, everyone thought everyone else got a pension except them. The rumours also circulated about how much of a military pension people got, but 9 times out of 10 this was also greatly exaggerated. And just remember, women were not actually permitted to apply for the pension in the 1920s. Aside from the financial constraints of the new Free State, part of the reason must have been because Cumann na mBan as an organisation went anti-treaty during the Civil War. This all changed in 1934 after Fianna Fáil had come to power. They were considered the anti-treaty party. They expanded the remit of the pension scheme greatly to encompass women and include those men and women on the anti-treaty side who had served during the Civil War. Albeit, of course, as we said, it was still mighty hard to get your hands on a pension. By and large, the sums of money on offer weren't vast amounts. You're talking on average of maybe between 3 and 5,000 euro per annum in today's terms. But to many of those in financial distress in the 1930s, the 1950s, Ireland wasn't by any means rich then, of course. This was a vital lifeline. By the way, applications were rejected if they did not meet the criteria for what would become an infamous term, active service. A range of activities were often deemed not sufficient to merit a pension, much to the annoyance of the applicants. Activities typically omitted from active service included electioneering duties, collecting subscriptions and fundraising generally, delivering dispatches, visiting prisons, providing clothes and shelter to men, scouting, providing first aid, and the cutting of communication lines. It was therefore very difficult for women to have their applications sanctioned. They could have spent years feeding and nursing IRA men, raising funds, delivering dispatches, buying and mending clothes, but still have their applications rejected. To be granted a pension, women usually had to prove that they transported or concealed weapons or ammo, even on just one occasion, carried out intelligence work, or were present in an area at the moment an ambush or attack was taking place. All of this backed up at references, of course. One of the most active women in the Kilkenny Cumann na mBan Brigade, Mary Tehan of Shipton House, was frustrated with the long drawn-out application process. Aged in her early 20s during the period in question, and spent most of the Civil War working full-time for the cause. She wrote to the Pensions Board in 1942, asserting the role played by women during the period. Quote, "We stood in the gap and had no guns to defend ourselves. The men ought to be proud of themselves, but I wonder where or how long would the IRA have lasted if they weren't fed and cleaned and encouraged by the women." End quote. One of Mary Tehan's referees, former IRA column commander from Tipperary, Senator Bill Quirk, strongly recommended that she be approved of a pension, stating, "In my opinion, it is an underestimation of the actual facts as I know them." End quote. In other words, she's not saying all the things she did. Tehan was eventually awarded a pension with over 3 years' service. In many ways, women weren't good at their own PR. They didn't like to blow their own trumpets at the expense of the men. Indeed, many men and some women did not even categorise all the domestic work involved as real work. In many ways, they were oblivious to how hard the various chores were. All this contributed to the diluting or omitting of the role of women during this era. In addition to the application process, once approved, pensions were graded from grades A to E from 1934. In monetary terms, E was the lowest rank and thus the lowest amount of money would be paid. Women of Cumann na mBan were only permitted to be given the grade of D or E under the Act. That's the lowest two ranks. So they would not be in the big bucks, even if they managed to have their pension claim approved. They also had to fight for how many years' service they had between 1960 and 1923. The more service, the higher the pension. Often certain periods and years could be approved fully or partially, but some could be discounted as not having enough activity. At the time of speaking, that's August 2021, 37 Cumann na mBan applications with a Kilkenny address have been published online. Of these 37, 26 were approved, including just two that were awarded the highest grade, that's grade D, namely the pensions of Hannah Dooley, later Murphy, and Mary Jo Power, later Cumann's, who I'll talk about in more detail in a minute. Now, the high approval rate there, 26 out of 37, is not likely to continue as more and more applications are released. The approved pensions were generally front-loaded at the start by the archivists, as obviously these were considered some of the key women of revolutionary-era Kilkenny. So, what about the history of the Cumann na mBan organisation in Kilkenny? It was actually late enough getting started, although this was not unusual. As mentioned, the national organisation was formed in 1914, but due to the outbreak of the First World War later that year and the split between the Irish Volunteers and the National Volunteers, it didn't get started in Kilkenny until January 1916. Now, in early 1916, an Irish volunteer organiser named Ted O'Kelly was sent to Kilkenny by Dublin headquarters to train, recruit, and better structure the small Irish volunteer companies in Kilkenny. Lieutenant O'Kelly was a Kildare native who would go on to acquire injuries near the GPO on Easter week. Kelly was also involved in the establishment of the 1st Cumann na mBan Battalion in Kilkenny on Sunday, the 9th of January 1916. Two people who would go on to be involved in all aspects of Cumann na mBan locally were elected there that very first night. Firstly, you had Hannah Dooley, later Murphy, of Dunningstown, which is just outside Kilkenny City. Dooley was elected leader of the Kilkenny City Battalion. The battalions were also referred to as district councils within Cumann na mBan to differentiate them from the IRA. And Dooley would in 1918 become leader of Cumann na mBan for the entire county of Kilkenny. The other member who was pivotal in setting up the organisation that day in Kilkenny was Maisie or Mary Stallard. She was one of the Stallard dynasty from Danville near Kilkenny, who were an old Fenian family. Kilkenny City had a strong tradition of Fenianism since the 1860s, as the founder of the movement was born in the city, he being James Stephens, of course. Many a revolutionary stayed in Danville over the years. The house was also the scene of numerous Kilkenny IRA brigade meetings during the War of Independence era. Maisie, along with her very active sisters Josie and Jenny, were prominent in the movement in Kilkenny from the very beginning. Their brother Tom was also heavily involved with the IRB and the Irish Volunteers in Kilkenny. He ran the family shop in Parliament Street in Kilkenny, and he later ran a cinema. The shop had an arms dump inside where weapons were concealed throughout the War of Independence for the 1st Battalion. Ammunition was even mixed into the big jars of sweets in the shop, the last place Crown Forces would think of looking. Also elected to Kilkenny Cumann na mBan committee that first night in Kilkenny was Winnie Delucre. She was wife of the local IRB head centre and later Sinn Féin mayor of Kilkenny, Peter Delucre. The Stallards and the Delucres were strong supporters of the Irish independence movement, even when it wasn't entirely fashionable to do so. They stuck up black flags in Kilkenny during the King and Queen's royal visit of 1904, black being the symbol of protest, of course. In the weeks prior to the Easter Rising of 1916, Maisie and her sister Jenny were sent to Dublin by Peter Delucre to collect revolvers and ammunition in Jury's Hotel. Maisie also was responsible for guiding Lee Mellows through Kilkenny on his way to County Galway during the week prior to Easter 1916. Mellows led the Galway Volunteers during Easter week, of course. As an aside, the Irish volunteer organiser Ted Kelly, who we mentioned, ended up recuperating in Danville after the wounds he received in Easter week 1916. Sparks of romance were obviously lit as Maisie and Ted later married. They obviously had been very close before he had went to the Rising, and she was very worried when his whereabouts in the weeks directly after the Rising were not known. He was, however, recuperating in Jervis Street Hospital and was smuggled out disguised as a priest before making his way to Danville. Another Irish volunteer man who recuperated at Danville, that being Liam Clark, ended up marrying Maisie's sister Josephine. So the revolution, aside from all the dangers involved, was actually a good place to find love, it seems. Clark had been very badly wounded in an accidental explosion in the GPO on Easter week 1916, where two of his men were killed. Josephine moved to Dublin, where she joined the central branch of Cumann na mBan. She was heavily involved in Cumann na mBan activities there and moved with the anti-treaty men in Dublin at the start of the Civil War. She qualified as a doctor in May 1921. Ted and Maisie, however, had less than 25 years together, unfortunately. Ted was killed in London during the Blitz bombings of 1940. He was working as a doctor there. Josie's husband, Liam, also passed away the following year, aged 48. He had suffered greatly due to the ailments picked up during the revolutionary years. Maisie lived for over 40 years after her husband's death, passing away in 1984 in her 92nd year. Dr. Josephine Clark, niece Dallard of Ratcool Dispensary, Dublin, died in March 1976, just 2 weeks shy of her 80th birthday. Now, just to get back to the Cumann na mBan structure in Kilkenny, by the War of Independence era, that's 1919 to 21, the Cumann na mBan Brigade mirrored their male counterparts in the IRA. That is, they formed into 9 matching battalions or district councils, which divided up County Kilkenny. Each battalion was subsequently subdivided into companies, often along parish lines. But because Cumann na mBan didn't contain the same number as men, the number of companies attached to each battalion was actually less, and some parishes were combined together. Now, the highest number of women recorded as being members of Cumann na mBan in Kilkenny was 821 women, and that was in 1921. Now, similar to their male counterparts, the strength and activities of each branch and member differed from district to district. Some just paid the membership fee and did very little else. Others worked day and night under the radar for the cause. A small number again took a more frontline role in ambushes and also providing safe houses. Towards the middle and the end of the War of Independence, some members of Cumann na mBan were more or less secret members or didn't officially join. This was a tactic to throw off the Crown forces so the women could be more useful in delivering dispatches and weapons without the Crown forces being aware of them, so there was less chance they'd be searched or their homes being raided. It must also be said that there was certainly more hostility to females being involved in revolutionary activities more so than the men. For example, a father may put up with his son's IRA activity, even if he was worried or didn't agree with this, but the same father might not condone his daughter being part of the same movement. But of course, this is different from family to family. Indeed, it is a point worth further study, perhaps, that some of the most active members of Cumann na mBan often fell into two different categories. The first being that they did not have brothers, husbands or fathers living at home. In other words, they had the freedom to make their own decisions. The men might have made it difficult for them to join if they did not agree with what they were doing. The most obvious example is Hannah Dooley, the brigade overall commander by 1919, who was single, whose father had been dead for many years and who lived with just her mother and two sisters. In other words, no men in the house. The other factor in the level of individual Cumann na mBan activity may have been having an extended household that was heavily involved in the independence movement, so the complete opposite. The Tian family of Shipton House near Kilmana springs to mind here, where most of the family appear to be involved in one way or other. The brothers were all in the IRA and the sisters were all in Cumann na mBan. The same could be said for the Luttrell family of Gary Ricken House. By the way, the RIC in Kilkenny vastly miscalculated the influence of Cumann na mBan in 1921, giving an estimate of just 70 women in the whole of County Kilkenny. Now, these were probably the most well-known women from each parish, but there was many silent supporters and helpers they wouldn't have necessarily known about. Although Kilkenny had a relatively large membership, OC Hannah Dooley said that many of the women were not inclined to take leadership roles. Quote, "I found it hard to get officers to take charge. Although they were all willing to join up, yet none liked to take charge," end quote. Although she does not offer any reason for this, it may have been because of family responsibilities or family disapproval like we just talked about earlier, or perhaps a negative perception of their activities within their local community. As the revolutionary years became more violent, women in Kilkenny also feared having their hair forcibly cut. This is also known as hair shorning. It was a punishment used by both the IRA and the Crown Forces, both of whom thought it a lenient penalty for a crime in inverted commas. The principal targets of Crown Force attacks were women who aided and abetted the IRA in its activities. These were usually members of Cumann na mBan and who were often related to an IRA member. The IRA used it to threaten women they felt were too close to members of the Crown Forces. Local jealousies cannot be discounted in this latter case. Hair cutting usually involved taking a woman out, usually at night, and cutting their hair very short. It was an era where long hair was more than just a fashion. It could be said that it defined one's femininity. Aside from being highly traumatic in how it was carried out, it made the victims marked women. The whole parish would see them with their hair cut at Sunday Mass, etc. It could also question the respectability, that awful word, of the family. In other words, there was a societal stigma and shame attached to it. Now, we've mentioned the overall leadership of Cumannamon in County Kilkenny. I'll now give details of the leadership of the battalions around the county so you can hear who was leader in your area. Perhaps some of the families are still there. So, as we mentioned already, Miss Hannah Murphy of Dunningstown, County Kilkenny, she was Ní Dualaigh. She was the OC or adjutant of the whole brigade of County Kilkenny from 1919 right up until 1924. The president then in the early years was Maisie O'Kelly, who we talked about, Niece Stallard. She later moved to London. She was replaced in the Civil War by Miss Aggie Bibby, who was from High Street, Kilkenny, and the treasurer then was Miss Charlie Bibby, her sister, also from High Street. They were shopkeepers' daughters as well. Now, they are sisters of Father Albert Bibby of the Capuchins, who was famous for giving the last rites to some of the executed 1916 leaders in Kilmainham Jail. Underneath them, you had other leaders around the county for all the different battalion areas. In the 1st Battalion around Kilkenny City, Josie Cullen was the main leader there and then replaced by Miss Egan during the Civil War. In the 2nd Battalion, Joe Tobin of Grana, Urlingford was the leader. In the 3rd Battalion, which is up around the Comer area, originally it was Molly Comfort of Coolbawn near Comer, and she was replaced in the Civil War by Mrs. Brennan of Gressie Yard. In the 4th Battalion area around Paulstown, Helen Fottrell, Ní Murphy, was the leader there throughout the period. In the 5th Battalion area, Miss Cusson of Crown was the leader. In the 6th Battalion area throughout, the leader down there was Miss Lena Buchel, Ní Mullins of Thomastown. In the very active 7th Battalion area, which takes in Callan and Kilmana, that neck of the woods, the leader there was Mrs. Kitty Bennett, later from John's Well, but she was Ní Tighean, one of the Tighean dynasty of Shipton House. She was the leader there throughout, and we'll talk about a little bit more about her in a minute. In the 8th Battalion area, Mary Jo Cummins, originally from Piltown, but later from Nine Mile House, she was Ní Power. She was a leader there throughout. And in the 9th Battalion area, you had the very active Miss Nora Durney, who was from Crown and Kilmacow, which and that area took in Kilmacow, Monkhine and beyond. Now, maybe just to give a flavour of some of the women in Kilkenny Cumannamon and their activities and their personal stories, I've picked out just a few examples. Now, we mentioned Hannah Dooley there on a few occasions, who was the leader of the whole county brigade throughout the period in question, and we'll start with a bit more detail about her. Besides all the admin and general work that the job entailed, she was also involved in some way or other in all the major planned IRA altercations in Kilkenny, so without question, an extremely active and dedicated member. In her teens, she had served her time as a draper's assistant, but her life was now basically full-time Cumannamon work. Hannah was born in 1891, making her approximately 30 years old during the period in question. She lived in Dunningstown, very near Kilkenny City. It's just out the Freshford Road direction. She was present in the vicinity of many of the altercations during the period to offer first aid to the IRA if necessary, including the Huggins Town RIC barracks attack and the Friary Street ambush. In the latter, the Friary Street ambush, she held on to a loaded revolver for Tom Hennessy in case he needed a fresh weapon when retreating. She was picked up by auxiliaries just after the Friary Street ambush and interrogated, but then released. The gun she had had wasn't captured. She would often deliver ammunition and weapons to carnies of the racecourse just outside Kilkenny, which was a central depot of sorts for arms and ammo, as Tom Carney became the quartermaster of the Kilkenny City Battalion. In the days after the Friary Street ambush, she said her house was raided by the RIC and the infamous district inspector, C.I. Weiss, dragged her out of bed in the middle of the night. She was taken to the military barracks in Kilkenny for questioning, which is now James Stephens Barracks, but again later released as she gave nothing away. Hannah got the nickname Kilkenny's Joan of Arc amongst the men for always being ready to help. A bomb making factory was also established close to her home in Dunningstown during the War of Independence, and she and her sisters catered for the people working there. The explosives were made by Kilkenny chemist Dan Stapleton, and his reliable handiwork was much sought after throughout the south of Ireland, not just in Kilkenny. Hannah's mother's horse and cart was used to deliver the ammo and explosives all around the county and beyond. During the truce, Hannah and Josie Stallard visited every Cumann na Mban company in County Kilkenny. She said there was a maximum of 36 branches or companies of Cumann na Mban in County Kilkenny at that stage, with an average membership of between 25 and 30 women in each branch. She collected £3 from each branch, sending over £100 to the central Cumann na Mban GHQ in Dublin. Staunchly anti-treaty, at the beginnings of the Civil War in May 1922, Hannah delivered dispatches throughout the Battle of Kilkenny, at one stage entering Kilkenny Castle while it was under heavy gunfire by Free State forces to provide ammunition and to deliver first aid to the injured anti-treaty leader Dick Brennan, who was inside the castle. She later followed the anti-treaty column that moved to Carrick-on-Shore via Piltown. There she was under the command of famed 1916 veteran Dr. Kathleen Lynn. During the Civil War, she also managed to get a visitor's card for Kilkenny Jail and visited anti-treaty prisoners quite regularly. She had usually visited daily and sometimes twice daily to bring parcels. On another occasion, she brought in a disguise and dressed anti-treaty IRA officer Eamon McCluskey, dressed him up as a woman, and literally the two of them walked out of the prison together. He made good his escape. He was a national teacher in Kilmana. She also got another prisoner, Mackie Purcellous, in much the same fashion. Excuse the pun. Needless to say, her visitor's car was soon revoked. The sergeant of the prison threatened to shoot her if he ever saw her again. Now, it should be noted that the women of Cumann na Mban were far more likely to be imprisoned during the Civil War than had ever been the case during the War of Independence. Nationally, you're talking just about maybe over 50 women who were imprisoned during the War of Independence, but during the Civil War, over 800 plus women were imprisoned. That's 50 versus 800, and we don't yet know the exact figure, and I'm piggybacking off Sinead McCool's research there. So that's multiples of women imprisoned in the Civil War by the Free State when compared to the Crown forces during the previous conflict. Now, we don't exactly know how many Kilkenny women were imprisoned during the Civil War, as the prison records don't exist, so we're kind of piecing it together using prison autographs books that the women kept and also using the pension files, but there's at least five, so it could be up to 10 and beyond. This could obviously have had long-term effects on the women themselves, but also their families and to the anti-treaty cause, who were heavily reliant on the women of Cumann na Mban. It was most likely the case that those on the Free State side understood their capabilities, having fought alongside women during the independence era, and therefore knew the value of women in attempting to fight a guerrilla war. Any Kilkenny women arrested and detained were sent to prisons in Dublin and not to Kilkenny, which was a male-only prison. Hannah Dooley was detained for short periods during the era, but then released. She was very careful not to be caught with anything incriminating, and she also didn't sleep at her home at the tail end of the Civil War for fear of arrest. It is also likely that certain Free State commanders from the area had a certain respect for her, however grudging, considering the service she had done during the War of Independence. Sending her to prison would not have been very popular. Now, just to note that the majority of the Cumann na Mban leadership in Kilkenny voted to reject the treaty, just like Cumann na Mban headquarters leadership did generally. So a split occurred in Kilkenny, just like it did everywhere else. Thus, the depleted Cumann na Mban was now a wholly anti-treaty organisation. However, most of the rank and file members of Cumann na Mban did accept the treaty, or at least remain neutral. Hannah Dooley estimated that the numbers in Cumann na Mban dropped by 2/3 during the Civil War following the split, so to between 200 and 300 women in the Kilkenny Brigade, down from 800 the previous year. Maisie Stallard estimated that of the 30 plus Cumann na Mban companies or councils around Kilkenny, only about 10 voted to take the anti-treaty Republican side. Those against the treaty stayed within Cumann na Mban, those supporting the treaty joined a new organisation. This new pro-treaty female organisation was called Cumann na Saoirse, which literally translates as the League of Freedom. At the inaugural meeting of the Kilkenny branch of the organisation, which was held in City Hall in April 1922, 1922, just before the Civil War broke out, Winnie the Lucree, wife of the mayor, was elected president. This organization received the unflattering nickname of Cumana Searchers from their former comrades in Cumana Mon. This was as a result of members of Cumana Searcha accompanying Free State soldiers on raids of homes and of suspected anti-treaty supporters. Along with pointing out the houses to the Free State soldiers, many of whom wouldn't have been from Kilkenny, the women were sometimes asked to physically search the females in the households being raided, hence the name. It no doubt caused great bitterness between the women in opposing factions, who knew each other so well in a small place like Kilkenny. The Cumana Searcha members in Kilkenny also provide medical assistance and entertainment to the Free State troops who had been injured or were convalescing in the military hospital. An unknown but probably substantial amount of women did not want to take sides and dropped out of Cumana Mon but did not join the new organisation. In November 1922, during the Civil War, Hannah Dooley gave an idea of the day-to-day tasks of the organisation, describing the minute activities of the anti-treaty Cumana Mon organisation in Kilkenny in a monthly report she sent to her superiors in Dublin. Quote, "As the Sissi is military Free State HQ, the girls are constantly watched by Cumana searchers and reports sent back to the Free State barracks. One girl is very good and entered the barracks and took a plan of it. She has also taken a plan of the jail and sent it on to Anti-Treaty Brigade GHQ. Literature is posted up on walls and gates about every week and stenciled mottos appear here and there on the walls. The literature is generally turned down, but the stencil and paintbrush work has not been interfered with. Dependents of anti-treaty IRA prisoners in jail or on the run are being looked after. Not nearly all cases. Some cases are very bad. Families of young children left without support." End quote. Dooley spent much of her time in the 1930s and 40s writing letters to the Military Pension Board on behalf of the women who served under her during the revolutionary years. On one occasion, she pleaded to the board for compassion for the women who had served under her command in Kilkenny. Quote, "I hope your board will see their way and do something for the poor girls who risked their lives and gave all to Ireland. I assure you they done a man's part in places." End quote. Hannah also believed the trauma, stress and intimidation caused by the constant raids of her family home by Crown forces and then later the Free State soldiers led to the premature deaths of her mother Margaret and two younger sisters Maggie and Nellie, all passing away in quick succession between 1924 and 1927. During the Civil War period she slept elsewhere, which meant her mother and two sisters bore the brunt of the Free State raids, sometimes raiding and searching twice a day. The year 1924 was indeed a terrible year for Hannah and of course her mother. In March, her sister Nellie, aged just 25, passed away. And then, just 4 months later, her other sister, Maggie, died aged just 27. Both officially died from TB, which they had picked up in the revolutionary years, but Hannah believed it was the stress and anxiety involved in those years and being generally run down that greatly contributed to the TB taking hold of their bodies. Maggie and Nellie were members of Cumana Mon, just like Hannah. 3 years later, in March 1927, their mother, Margaret, died of stomach cancer, aged just 62 years. Having nursed both her sisters and mother in their final illnesses, Hannah found herself alone in the home house. However, she was not alone for long. Just 6 months later, Hannah Dooley married Daniel Murphy of Kilree in St. Canice's Church, Kilkenny Sissi, on the 19th of September 1927. She was aged 36 and her husband was 10 years older. Two children quickly followed in 1928 and 1930. They lived at her home place in Dunningstown. Daniel died in 1960 and Hannah died 9 months later on the 20th of September 1961, just a day after their 34th wedding anniversary. She was just shy of her 70th birthday. Hannah Murphy was awarded the highest grade for women, Grade D military service pension. She's certainly done her bit for the cause of Irish independence, that's in no doubt. Another very important member of Cumana Mon in County Kilkenny was Mary Josephine Mary Jo Commons, née Power, originally from Brainer in Piltown, but later Nile Mile House, just on the Kilkenny Tip border. She was one of the principal Cumana Mon officers in the Kilkenny Brigade, and towards the second half of the Civil War period, ran South Kilkenny Cumana Mon along with the help of Nora Durney, who was based in Kilmacow. Mary Jo was captain of her native Tempeloran branch of Cumana Mon, that's the 8th Battalion. During the War of Independence in early 1921, she was close to the scene of the planned Besborough and Fidown ambushes to provide first aid and dispatch carrying. Our home near Nilemine House was situated just inside the Tipperary border, which provided a perfect place to rest for the ASUs, or Flying Columns as they were known, that roamed West Kilkenny. She was also the first to medically attend to 19-year-old Jackie Brett, who was accidentally shot near Winegap. She got a doctor to help him, but he subsequently died. Her brother Paddy Power, later a horse trainer from Kilmaganny, was a member of the famed West Kilkenny Flying Column. He was present when Pat Welch and Sean Quinn were mortally wounded in Tullerone. Her other brother, Ned Power of Brainer, was a prominent member of the Piltown IRA and was interned in Kilworth Camp and later Spike Island in Cork. She was used on numerous occasions to deliver weapons and ammunition to the column. Mary Jo's responsibilities increased greatly during the Civil War as the ASU Flying Column men regularly stayed at her home, which required her to do many practical tasks, such as cooking, cleaning, sewing, washing and purchasing clothes for her anti-treaty visitors. She was also tasked, usually at short notice it must be said, with delivering dispatches to various parts of South and West Kilkenny, often on numerous occasions in one day, was a 15-mile distance the norm on foot or on bike. Like Hannah Dooley, she was present in the battlefields around Carrickonshore during the fighting there in August 1922, rendering first aid to those anti-treaty men who required it. She was arrested by Free State soldiers in March 23 and imprisoned in the North Dublin Union and later Kilmainham Jail in Dublin. She subsequently took part in two hunger strikes while incarcerated. The conditions within the jail were horrendous, with massive overcrowding in a damp, cold environment. She was eventually released on health grounds in November 23 after a 30-day hunger strike. She experienced ill health for the remainder of her life, including persistent rheumatic attacks, as she called them, which she attributed to conditions she endured as well as the hunger strikes. Endeavouring to pay her the highest compliment, Ned Elward, anti-treaty IRA brigade commander, said, quote, "There were few better than her in the county, and in my opinion, she was the most trustworthy man," in inverted commas, "in the area. I would ask the pensions board to call me in to give personal evidence in this case should there be any doubt of her claim for a full pension," end quote. Now, I know praising women by comparing them to men might seem sexist in today's world, but it was genuine, and a number of commanders made the point that certain women did much more work and were much more valuable to the cause than some of the men. Martin Medler is another who said he would put the contribution and record of Margaret Welch, later Prendergast, of Paulstown, on par with the men of his elite flying column. Now, going back to Mary Jo, she had many tough and difficult years following the revolutionary years. She married Philip Commons in January 1930 when she was 38 years old, again quite old when the average marriage age for women is in their early 20s. Her husband was later unable to work due to a medical condition, but their relationship was somewhat strained from early on. To make ends meet for her four children, which quickly followed her marriage, she ran a small farm. But even in the 1930s and beyond, she found it difficult to sell her wares, as most of the farmers near her were Free State supporters and refused to buy stock and produce from her because of her and her husband's prominence on the anti-treaty side in the Civil War years. In the 1940s, Mary Jo Cummins was awarded a Grade D military pension for her efforts, the highest grade available, after she had appealed her initial grade of E. This was a small victory, as the vast majority of women were graded E, as we said before. She also had a whopping 4-year service approved, which was well above the average and which is likely the highest of any Kilkenny woman in this area, although, as we said, the full record says it's not yet available. A number of well-known combatants of the era, including Dan Breen and Senator Bill Quirk, praised her contribution to the cause, no doubt helping to change the original decision of the pension board. Mary Jo Cummins died in 1980 at the age of 88. Another Kilkenny woman who was awarded a pension was Ali Luttrell, later Cantwell, from Gary Ricken House in West Kilkenny. The home of her parents was used continuously during the period. When the Crown Forces raided the house in March 1921, when the West Kilkenny Flying Column were staying there, Ali cleverly put on column member Paddy Ryan's Irish Volunteer uniform under her own clothes so it wouldn't be found in her parents' house. She later gave it back to Paddy Ryan and he kept it proudly for the rest of his life. During the Civil War in November 1922, she received a letter telling her to go to a window in Kilkenny Jail at a certain time. A stone with a letter attached was thrown from the window of the jail and it told her to have people ready the following Thursday night as the anti-treaty prisoners were making an escape tunnel, the second such escape tunnel in Kilkenny in a year. She was obviously totally trusted with that information.
She organised a flying column to be ready, and a number of prisoners escaped from Kilkenny jail that night. As an aside, generally the anti-treaty prisoners inside Kilkenny jail were well looked after, mostly because of the work of the Cumann na mBan members. The women had a rota, taking it in turns to visit anti-treaty internees to boost morale. They also raised money to buy provisions for the men. In just one day alone, for example, on the 4th of November 1922, 220 parcels were delivered to Kilkenny jail. Some of these were probably sent from the prisoners' families, but the vast majority can be attributed to the Cumann na mBan, who used the money they collected to make hampers for the prisoners. All Souls and All Saints Day had just passed, so it would have been a holy day. We can only imagine the amount of barn brack and that must have been delivered in those parcels. To put the volume of parcels into context, only 23 regular letters were received that day versus 220 parcels received. The Tehans of Shipton House near Kilmana were another revered family when it came to Cumann na mBan. Shipton House would be known more to recent generations as the place where the Greig Ballycallan hurlers and footballers would train and play matches prior to the building of their club grounds. The Tehan sisters, including Molly Tehan, later Foley, and Kissy Tehan, later Bennett, were involved in the independence struggle at the very highest level. This was because their home was something of a GHQ or headquarters for the 2nd Southern Division, which took in counties Tipperary and Kilkenny. Its position near the border made it an ideal location. Just like Gary Ricken House, there were two separate living quarters at Shipton, which also helped greatly for the visiting men. It meant for the women that besides all the scousing and domestic chores required, they often had to drop everything and travel to Dublin with dispatches. Also, in November 1921, 8 escapees from Kilkenny Jail arrived at Shipton and were looked after there for a few days, including the rebel priest, Father P.H. Delahunty, and Tom McCarrick of the Sligo Leitrim IRA. The likes of Ernie O'Malley, Dan Breen, Sean Hogan and Tom Barry also stayed and had meetings there on occasion. The Tehan family home in Shipton was even more of a focal point during the Civil War than it had been in the War of Independence. Eamon de Valera, Austin Stack and Frank Aiken stayed there during this period. On one occasion, Kissy Tehan escorted de Valera from Shipton to his home in Dublin, out of harm's way. Travelling with a companion female was usually a safer option than just going alone or with a group of men, which could raise suspicions. On another occasion, she travelled again with De Valera from Shipton, but this time to the Nire Valley on the Waterford Tip border. When Kissy Tehan applied for her pension in the 1940s, De Valera, then Taoiseach, said he would be, quote, only too pleased to answer any questions related to her application. The women also had to do grim tasks. When Thomas O'Dea of Cork was killed nearby during the Civil War, they collected his body, cleaned him and waked him at their home. Along with Margaret Pegmarney O'Keefe of Callan, they procured a coffin and travelled to Mitchelstown, County Cork, with his remains. The extended Tehan family suffered greatly for the cause. Just after De Valera had stayed there towards the end of the Civil War, the house was burnt down by Free State troops. The Tehan women had to go on the run after this as they were in line to be arrested. The house was later rebuilt. The Tehan Cumann na mBan girls were just around 20 years old or a bit above at the time in question, so very, very young. Generally, the turmoil of the Civil War must have been difficult for the women just as much as the men. In one unusual case, Eileen O'Brien, Ní Tobin of Cumann na mBan and Mulnahone switched sides. She had been a leading and well-known member of Cumann na mBan in the area during the War of Independence. Initially taking the anti-treaty side, she catered for IRA men in July 1922, but her brother, who was a commandant in the Free State Army, sent Colonel Frank Thornton, one of Michael Collins' most trusted lieutenants, to see her to convince her to change sides. They knew the value of the support she would be giving to the anti-treaty side in the area. He convinced her to switch. However, soon after, she had to move out of her house and live near the Free State Barracks in Clonmel for her own safety, as she was seen as a turncoat by the anti-treaty side. Another Cumann na mBan woman who was awarded a pension was Maisie or Mary Barris, Ní Gaffney from Cuffs Grange. Her greatest contribution probably came at the beginning of the Civil War, when she undoubtedly saved the lives of a number of anti-treaty men resting in Cuffs Grange. A large column of anti-treaty soldiers were resting and sleeping in a field near Cuffs Grange. Maisie was posted up on top of the church belfry tower in Cuffs Grange Church, which is still there, and she was with Sean Darmody, an IRA volunteer. Using binoculars, she spotted a motorised car of Free State soldiers coming from the Kilkenny direction. She was able to give warning to the men resting in the fields using signalling, and just in the nick of time, they were able to set up a machine gun post to repel the Free State soldiers when they arrived in the village. They had avoided being caught on the hop. Another lady, Nan O'Mar ní Landy of Gusana near Carrickonshore, was a member of the Tullahocht Company near Winegap. She had the unenviable task in April 1921 of reburying the remains of 19-year-old Jackie Bress. Jackie was an IRA column man who was accidentally shot nearby. He had actually also played in the charity match on Bloody Sunday up in Croke Park for the Tipperary footballers. Bress and the West Kilkenny Flying Column would have stayed at herself and her husband's house on different occasions previously. She had to secretly bury Brett's makeshift coffin in the middle of the night on her land. She didn't even let the servant girl who was asleep in the house know what she was doing in case word got out. There was a fear Crown Forces would take the body. She planted manhole drills over the remains so as the disturbed ground would not look suspicious. So just to conclude now, I think it's safe to say that the women of Cumannamon in Kilkenny sacrificed much during the revolutionary period. They may not have been shooting a gun in ambush, but their contribution to the cause was no doubt essential, with extensive and varying roles. I think I'll finish up where I started and leave the last word to Maisie Stallard, who was Cumannamon Brigade President in Kilkenny up to 1921. She succinctly put how her Cumannamon work became all-encompassing during the 1919-1923 period, while completing the process of applying for her military service pension, which she was eventually granted. She was called in for a face-to-face interview with the pension board, at which specific dates were requested for all the different Cumannamon activities she participated in. Now, she could not remember the specific dates off the top of her head, but having dwelled on it, she wrote the panel some days later, having thought about it, and stated in one of my favourite quotes from the period, "You had better leave the dates out, I think, as in those days, every night was Cumannamon," end quote. And I think that's where we leave it today. Just to thank you all again for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. And don't forget to join your local library to avail of all the amazing free resources. Until next time.